hung, folded, limp, spineless. And like a paper doll, he could tear me in half if he wanted to. "Stop fighting me, Miss Lane, and it'll go easier. Unless you enjoy the pain." In my mind, I spewed a geyser of curses, but not a word came out. I had no breath to fuel it. He had topped the level he'd used on me last night, the level of proficiency he'd said the Lord Master had achieved, and he'd done it with a voice of silk. Like the difference between other men's motorcycles and his, Barons walk softly, but he carries the biggest stick I've ever seen. "Nice tan, Miss Lane. How's Blaine? Did you have a good time today? I take you to graveyards, but he takes you to the beach. Is that what our problem is? Our little dates aren't good enough for you. Does he romance you? Feed you all those pretty lies you're so hungry for? I've been neglecting you lately. I'll be remedying that. Sit. Over there." He pointed to a chair near the fire. I jerked upright and tiptoed tightly toward the indicated seat, not because I felt dainty, but because that's what happens when you try to lock down your leg muscles to prevent your feet from rising and falling, but your body moves anyway. One resistant step after the next, I minced toward the chair. I reached it and collapsed into it like a rag doll. My throat muscles convulsed, and I tried to force out words.
"Don't do...
You will not speak unless it is in direct answer to one of my questions." My lips sealed. I couldn't believe he was doing this to me. How ironic that Blaine had asked me to trust him today. I had, and he hadn't betrayed me. I'd been ready to open up a little to Barons tonight, tell him a few things, and he'd betrayed me. Blaine had muted his sexuality to preserve my will. Barons had just stripped it away with a single command, no different from the Lord Master.
"Tell me what you saw the night you encountered the Shi-Sadu," he repeated.
Straining in my skin, nearly suffocating myself with my attempts to resist, I spilled every detail, every last thought, every perception. From the humiliation of lying in that vile puddle in my pretty clothes, to the various forms the book had taken, to the look it had given me, to my decision about how to track it. Then, to make things worse, I volunteered my entire intervention with Inspector Jane.
"Don't move," he said,
and I sat ramrod straight in my chair, unable to even scratch my nose while he pondered his thoughts. There was violence in the room with us, a killing violence. I didn't get it. What had I done to piss him off so much? He hadn't been half this angry last night, and he'd had every opportunity to grill me forcibly then. He hadn't. He'd just driven off.
"Where did you go today?"
Sweat dripping down my face, I told him that too. I wanted to speak of my own free will, to call him every name in the book, to tell him we were through, he and I, and that I was the one who deserved answers, not him. But he'd sealed my lips with a command, and I could only answer what he asked.
"Did Blaine tell you anything?"
"Yes," I said flatly, fighting it off there. I'd obeyed the compulsion to the letter. I didn't have to offer more.
"What did he tell you?"
"That the Lord Master was once a fae named Darok." He snorted.
"Old news. Did he tell you anything about me?"
"Old news? He'd been sitting on information about the Lord Master that he hadn't shared with me? And he got pissed at me for not telling him everything I knew? If he didn't kill me when he was done with me, he was dead. He was a walking encyclopedia with a cover I couldn't crack. Useless. Dangerous. No."
"Did you fuck him?"
"No," I gritted.
"Have you ever fucked him?"
"No," I ground out. I've never had two men more obsessed with what was happening in my sex life, or rather, not happening. Some of the violence in the air abated. My eyes narrowed. Was this it? The source of his rage? Was Barons jealous? Not because he cared, but because he thought of me as a possession, his personal and private she-seer, and there would be no other men's erections interfering with her oop detections. He gave me a cold look.
I needed to know if you were Praya. That's why I asked.
Do I look Praya? I snapped. I had no idea what a fey addict looked like, but I somehow doubted I was the poster girl for it. I figured them for something more like the goth girls I'd seen hanging out at Malusha's vampire lair, pierced, tattooed, and heavily made up, dressed in vintage clothing, mostly black. He started, measured me a moment, then laughed.
Ha ha ha! Good for you, Miss Lane. You're learning.
I started myself, realized what I'd just done. I'd said something that hadn't been an answer to a direct question. I tried to do it again, mentally forming the words, but I couldn't force them out. I didn't know how I'd done it in the first place.
Who were you going to see the night you saw the Shisadu?
Oh, no. This wasn't fair. He didn't get to know everything. A guy that knew Alina, I said between clenched teeth.
Tell me his name.
No, no, no. Christian McKelter.
Are you fucking kidding me?
He exploded from his chair and glared down at me. Since he'd used voice, I was obligated to say no, although I knew the question had been rhetorical. The killing violence was back over a simple name. Why? What significance did Christian's name have to him? Did he know him? Closing my eyes, I sought the She-Seer place in my head. It was no help. I still couldn't speak. How could I feel so much power in that hot, alien part of my mind, yet find nothing there of use to me in this situation?
How did you meet Christian McKelter?
He works at the ALD at Trinity. I met him when you sent me to pick up the invitation to the auction from his boss, but she wasn't there.
His nostrils flared. He must be a recent hire. They've been spying on me.
He hadn't used voice, nor had he asked a question, so I said nothing.
Have the McKelters been spying on me?
Squeezing my eyes shut, I said, yes.
Have you been spying on me, Miss Lane?
As much as I can.
What have you learned about me?
I went poking around in my head again, but whatever place I was supposed to discover remained a mystery to me. Aware that I was digging my own grave, one spadeful of information at a time, I told him. That I knew he wasn't human, that I knew he was impossibly old, that I'd watched him step out of the unseelie sifting silver he kept in his study, carrying the savagely brutalized corpse of a woman, that, like the shades, the demons in there had fled his path. He laughed, as if it was some kind of joke that I knew all his dark secrets. He didn't try to explain or justify one bit of it.
And I didn't think you could keep your own counsel. You knew these things and never said a word. You're becoming interesting. Are you working with the McKelters against me?
No.
Are you working with Blaine against me?
No.
Are you working with the She-Seers against me?
No.
Are you working with anyone against me?
No.
Where do your loyalties lie, Miss Lane?
With myself, I shouted. With my sister, with my family, and screw all of you! The violence in the room abated. After a moment, Behrens resumed his seat in the chair across from me, absorbed my painfully stiff posture, and smiled without humor.
Very well, Mac. Relax.
Mac? He called me Mac? I fought for breath. Am I about to die? I wheezed. Are you going to kill me? He looked startled. I'd done it again, spoken of my own will. He'd released my body, but not his hold on my mind and mouth. I could still feel it, compelling me, hurting me. Then he snorted.
I tell you to relax, and you think I'm going to kill you? You're crippled by a woman's illogic.
He added as a seeming afterthought.
You may speak freely now.
The stranglehold on my throat was gone, and for a few moments I simply enjoyed the sensation of breath moving in and out of my lungs, of knowing my tongue was once again my own. I could feel Vlaine's name piercing the meat of it, and realized that from the moment Behrens had used voice to bind my will, it had somehow faded, receded beyond my reach. I am not. The only two times you ever called me Mac is when I was near death. Since there's no other threat around right now, you must be about to kill me. It's perfectly logical.
I didn't call you Mac.
Yes, you did.
I called you Miss Lane.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
I clenched my jaw. Sometimes, despite Baron's eternal old-world sophistication and my glamour girl cool, he and I very nearly devolve into childish fights. Frankly, I didn't give a rat's petunia what he'd called me, and wasn't about to sit here and argue about it. I was free and furious. I exploded from my chair, launched myself at him, and slammed both palms against his chest. I put every ounce of determination to null into my hands that I could summon. My she-seer core blazed like a small fiery sun in my head. Was he or wasn't he unseelie? I hit him so hard that his chair toppled backward and we went skidding across the floor toward the fireplace, stopping inches from the grate. If he froze at all, it was for so brief a moment that I couldn't decide if I'd nulled him or merely startled him into a brief second of immobility. Figured, more non-answers where Baron's was concerned. I reared back, straddling him, and punched him in the jaw as hard as I could. He started to speak, and I punched him again. I wished I'd eaten Unseelie. I was going to go eat 10 of them tonight, then come back here and finish him off. The hell with answers. How dare you saunter in here and force me to give you answers when you've never given me a single one? I hissed. I punched him in the stomach hard. He didn't even wince. I punched him again. Nothing.
You stand there all tan and glowing and wonder why I use voice on you, he bellowed. Where the hell do you get off? You've been with Blaine again. How many slaps in the face do you think I'm going to take, Miss Lane?
He grabbed my fist and held it when I tried to punch him again. I swung at him with the other. He caught that, too.
I warned you not to play us against each other.
I'm not playing you. I'm trying to survive. And I don't slap you when I go off with Blaine. I tried to yank my fists from his hands. It doesn't have anything to do with you. I'm trying to get answers, and since you won't give me any, you can't blame me for going somewhere else.
So, the man who doesn't get laid at home has the right to go off and cheat?
Huh?
Which word didn't you understand?
He sneered. You're the one who's crippled by illogic. This isn't home, it never will be, and nobody's getting laid. I practically shouted.
You think I don't know that?
He shifted his body beneath me, making me painfully aware of something. Two somethings, in fact, one of which was how far up my short skirt was. The other wasn't my problem. I wriggled to shimmy my hem down, but his expression perished the thought. When Baron's looks at me like that, it rattles me. Lust, in those ancient obsidian eyes, offers no trace of humanity. Doesn't even bother trying. Savage Mac wants to invite it to come out and play. I think she's nuts. Nuts, I tell you. Let go of my hands.
Make me,
he taunted.
Voice me, Miss Lane. Come on, little girl. Show me some power.
Little girl, my ass. You know I can't. And that makes what you did to me tonight even more unforgivable. You might as well have raped me. In fact, that's exactly what you did. He rolled hard and fast, and I was on my back beneath him, with my hands pinned above my head, the weight of his body crushing me to the floor, his face inches from mine. He was breathing harder than the exertion merited.
Make no mistake, Miss Lane, I didn't rape you. You can lie there on your pretty little PC ass and claim with your idealistic little PC arguments that any violation of your will is rape, and that I'm a big bad bastard, and I'll tell you that you're full of shit, and you've obviously never been raped. Rape is much, much worse. Rape isn't something you walk away from. You crawl.
He was off me and on his feet, stalking out the door before I'd even managed to catch enough breath to reply.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Fae Fever by Karen Marie Monning.
performed by Joyce Bean. Part 2. The Darkest Hour. Nightfall. What a strange word. Night, I get. But fall is a gentle word. Autumn leaves fall, swirling with languid grace to carpet the earth with their dying blaze. Tears fall, like liquid diamonds shimmering softly before they melt away. Night doesn't fall here. It comes slamming down. Max Journal. Chapter 10. I slept fitfully and dreamed of the sad woman again. She was trying to tell me something, but an icy wind kept stealing her words each time she opened her mouth. Laughter rippled on the chilling breeze, and I thought I recognized it, but I couldn't lift the name from my mind. The harder I tried, the more frightened and confused I became. Then Blaine was there, and Barons, too, with men I'd never seen before, and suddenly Christian appeared, and Barons moved toward him with murder in his eyes. I woke up, iced to the bone, and in a state of alarm. My subconscious had put something together that hadn't penetrated my conscious mind. Today was Thursday. Christian was returning from Scotland, and Barons was on to him because of me. I had no idea what Barons might do to him, and didn't want to find out. The lie-detecting Kelter was no match for whatever my employer was. Teeth chattering, I grabbed my cell off the night table and called the ALD. The dreamy-eyed boy answered and told me Christian wasn't due in until afternoon. I asked for an apartment, home, or cell number, and he said the personnel files were locked up in the department head's office. She was gone for a long holiday weekend and wouldn't be back until Monday. I left an urgent message for Christian to call me the instant he walked in. I was about to tug the covers up, snuggle down, and try to shiver myself warm when my phone rang. It was Danny.
"She almost caught me, Mac," she said breathlessly. "She didn't leave PHI at all yesterday. She slept in her office, and I was up all feckin' night waiting for a chance to get in. Then a few minutes ago, she finally went downstairs for breakfast, I thought, and I slipped in, but I couldn't find the book you wanted. There was another one in her desk, so I took pictures of it, but I didn't get many because she came right back, and I had to go out the feckin' window and tore my uniform and banged myself up something wicked. I couldn't get what you asked for, but I tried, and I got something else. That counts, doesn't it? Will you still meet up with us?"
"Are you okay?" She snorted.
"I killed monsters, Mac. I fell out of a stupid window."
I smiled. "Where are you?" I could hear horns honking in the background, the sounds of the city waking up.
"Not far from you,"
she told me. I knew the intersection. I glanced at the window. It was still dark out. I hated her being out there in the dark, regardless of her super speed, and I doubted she had the sword. "There's a church across the street." It was brilliantly lit. "I'll meet you in front of it in 10 minutes.
"But the rest of them aren't here."
"I'm just coming for my camera. Can you get the girls together this afternoon?"
"I can try. Kat says you have to pick a place where the other couriers won't see us."
I named several cafes, all of which she nixed as too risky. We finally settled on a below-street pub, aptly named The Underground, that offered darts and pool tables but no windows. I hung up, brushed my teeth, splashed water on my face, tugged on jeans, and zipped a fleece-lined jacket over my PJ top, then jammed a ball cap on my head. My blonde roots were showing. I made a mental note to stop in a drugstore on the way back and grab a couple boxes of color. It was depressing enough that I had to have dark hair. I wasn't going to cheese it up with a sloppy dye job. It was 7:20 when I hit the pavement. The sun wouldn't rise until 7:52 a.m. It would set at 6:26. I've become a bit obsessed with the precise timing of natural light and keep a chart of it on my wall, next to the map where I track unseely hotspots and book activity. I stayed to the lights as much as I could, moving from the pool cast by one street lamp to the next, a flashlight in each hand, my spear heavy and comforting in my shoulder harness. My Mac Halo was for deep night work only. If the people passing by thought it was bizarre that I was carrying lit flashlights, I didn't care. I was staying alive. They could smirk all they wanted. A few of them did. As I hurried down the street, I pictured myself 3 months ago, compared it to what I looked like now, and laughed. The businessman hurrying along next to me glanced over. He met my eyes, jerked a little, and stepped up his pace, leaving me behind. It had rained during the night, and the cobbled streets were shiny in the pre-dawn light. The city perched on the expectant edge of day about to explode. Buses honking, taxis vying for space with commuters, people checking their watches and rushing to their jobs. Other people, or things, already doing theirs, like those rhino boys sweeping the streets and picking up trash. I watched them surreptitiously, struck by the oddity of it. The non-she-seer passerby would see only the human glamour they projected, of the still half-asleep city employee, but I saw their stumpy gray limbs, beady eyes, and jutting jaws as plain as the skin on the back of my hand. I knew they were watchdogs for higher-ranking fae. I didn't get why they were doing human dirty work. I couldn't see a fae stooping to it, light or dark court. The many low-level unseelie were chafing my she-seer senses. Usually rhino boys don't bother me too much, but in mass numbers they make me feel like I have an ulcer. I poked around inside my head, wondering if I could mute it somehow. That was better. I could turn the volume down. Very cool. Danny was leaning jauntily against a street lamp in front of the church, bike propped against her hip. She had a painful-looking knot on her forehead. The undersides of her forearms were scraped raw and dirty, and she'd torn holes in the knees of her pinstriped pants as if she'd gone sliding on all fours down an asphalt roof, which, she told me breezily, she had. I wanted to take her back to the bookstore, clean and bandage her up. I told my bleeding heart to get over it. If we ever ended up fighting back to back, I'd need to trust her to deal with all but critical wounds. Danny slapped the camera into my hand with a cocky grin and said, "Go ahead, tell me what a great job I did." I suspected she didn't hear praise often. Rowena didn't seem the type to waste breath on a job well done when she could save it for a job badly done. I also doubted Danny got much nurturing from the other she-seers. Her mouthy defensiveness made her hard to cuddle, and her sisters-in-arms had their own worries on their minds. I thumbed on the camera, glanced at the measly 7 pages she'd photographed of the wrong stuff, and said, "Great job, Danny." She preened a moment, then hopped on her bike and pedaled off, skinny legs pumping. I wondered if she ever used her super speed while biking, and if she did, would you see only a flash of green whizzing by? Kermit the Frog on steroids.
"Later, Mark," she said over her shoulder. "I'll call you soon."
I headed back to the bookstore by way of the drugstore. It was light enough to put away my flashlights. I did, then stared down at my camera, zooming in on the photos, trying to figure out what she'd gotten. I knew better than to walk with my head down. I didn't even dare carry an umbrella in the rain for fear of what I might bump into. When I careened off the shoulder of a man standing near a dark, expensive car parked at the curb, I exclaimed, "Oh, sorry," and kept right on going, blessing my luck that it had been a human I'd bumped into, not a fae, when I realized I had my volume way down, and it hadn't been a human. I whirled, whipping my spear from my jacket, willing the people passing by, most with their noses buried in a newspaper or on their cell phones, not to see me, as if maybe I could throw a little glamour of my own, melt into the shadows with the other monsters. "Bitch!" spat Derek O'Banion, his swarthy features contorted with hatred. But his cold reptilian gaze acknowledged my weapon, and he made no move toward me. Ironically, that weapon is the spear I stole from his brother, Rocky, shortly before Barons and I led him and his henchmen to their death by shade behind the bookstore. Capitalizing on Derek's hunger for revenge, the L.M. recruited him as a replacement for Malouche, taught him to eat unseelie, and sent him after me to get the spear. I'd convinced the younger O'Banion brother that I would kill him if he so much as blinked at me wrong, and I'd let him know just how terrible that death would be. The spear killed anything Fey. When a person ate on Seelie, it turned parts of the person Fey. When those parts died, they rotted from the inside out, poisoning the human parts of the person and ultimately killing them. The one time I'd eaten Fey, I'd been terrified of the spear. I'd seen Melush up close and personal. He'd been marbled with decay. Half his mouth had rotted. Parts of his hands, legs, and stomach had become a decomposing stew. And his genitals? Ugh. It was a horrific way to die. O'Banion yanked open the car door, muttered something to the driver, then slammed it again. The engine turned over, and 12 cylinders purred to the quiet life of understated wealth. I smiled at him. I love my spear. I understand why boys at war name their guns. He fears it. The royal hunters fear it. With the exception of the Shades, who have no substance to stab, it will kill anything Fey, allegedly even the king and queen themselves. Someone I couldn't see pushed the rear car door open from the inside. O'Banion rested his hand on the top of the window. He was far more riddled with Fey than he had been a week and a half ago. I could feel it. "Little addictive, huh?" I said sweetly. I dropped my spear, pressed it to my thigh, to dissuade potential busybodies from calling the Garda. I wasn't willing to sheathe it. I knew how fast and strong he was. I'd been there myself, and it had been incredible.
"You should know."
"I only ate it once." Probably wasn't so wise to admit that just then, but I was proud of the battle I'd been winning.
"Bullshit. Nobody who's tasted the power would give it up."
"We're not the same, you and I." He wanted dark power. I didn't. Deep down, I just wanted to go back to being the girl I used to be. I would trespass into darker territories only if my survival depended on it. O'Banion considered embracing the darkness a step up. I feinted a jab at him with my spear. He flinched, and his mouth compressed to a thin white line. I wondered if he stopped eating it now. Would he revert to fully human, or, after a certain point, was it too late and the transformation couldn't be undone? How I wished I'd let him walk into the dark zone that day. I couldn't fight him here and now in the middle of rush hour. "Get out of here!" I stabbed air again. "And if you see me on the street, run as fast and as far as you can." He laughed.
"You stupid little cunt! You have no idea what's coming. Wait till you see what the Lord Master has in store for you."
He ducked into the car and glanced back at me with a smile of malevolence and sick anticipation.
"Trick or treat, bitch,"
he said, and laughed again. I could hear him laughing, even after he'd closed the door. I tucked the spear in my harness, then stood on the sidewalk gaping as he drove away. Not because of anything he'd said, but because of what I'd seen as he'd settled back into the supple, camel-colored leather seats. Or, rather, who I'd seen. A woman, beautiful and voluptuous, in the way of aging movie stars from a time long gone by, when actresses had been worthy of the title Diva. My volume was on high. She was eating Fey, too. Well, now I knew. While Barons might have killed the woman he'd been carrying out of the mirror, he hadn't killed Fiona. I opened Barons' Books and Baubles at 11 on the dot with a new do. I'd colored it 2 shades lighter than Arabian Nights this time and looked closer to my age again. Black hair makes me look older, especially with red lipstick. Then run down the street for a quick cut, and now a few longish wedges of bang framed my face. The result was feminine and soft, completely at odds with how I felt inside. The rest of it I twisted up and stabbed with a hairpick. The result was flirty, casual elegance. My nails were cut to the quick, but I'd brushed on a quick coat of perfectly pink and glossed on matching lipstick. Despite these concessions to my passion for fashion, I felt drab in my standard uniform of jeans, boots, a black tee under a light jacket, with spear holstered and flashlights tucked. I missed dressing up. I sat back on the stool behind the cashier counter, and I'd the tiny jars of wriggling, unseelie flesh lined up there. I'd managed to cram a lot into my morning. After the drugstore, I'd hit a corner convenience, bought baby food, dyed my hair, showered, emptied the contents, and washed the jars. Then I'd gone out again, attacked a rhino boy, cut off part of his arm and stabbed him, putting him out of both of our miseries, and making sure he didn't live to tell any tales of a human girl stealing fey power. Then I'd sliced and diced the stump of arm into bite-sized pieces. If only I'd kept some handy, as I'd wanted to after feeding Jane, Moira might not have died. If something unexpected and awful happened while I was in the bookstore, I wasn't going to be caught unprepared this time. I wanted a dose of superpower close at hand. It wasn't as if it would ever expire. It was the only snack I knew of with an immortal shelf life. My hunting and gathering expedition had nothing to do with Derek O'Banion or Fiona, or the reminder of how weak I was compared to them. It was proactive. It was smart. It was just plain good common sense. I slid the small fridge out from beneath the rear counter and tucked several jars behind it before sliding it back in. The others I would stash away upstairs later. After catching myself staring at them for several minutes without blinking, I stuffed the jars in my purse. Out of sight, out of mind. I opened my laptop, hooked up my camera, and began uploading the pages. While I waited, I called the ALD again to make sure the dreamy-eyed boy really understood the urgency of the message I'd asked him to relay. He assured me he did. I tended to customers for the next several hours. It was a busy morning, and sales were brisk. It wasn't until early afternoon that I got to sit down and take a look at the pages Danny had photographed. I was disappointed by how small they were, barely the size of recipe cards. The scribbled lines were cramped tightly together, and when I finally managed to begin deciphering the small, slanted script, I realized what I had was a pocket notebook of observations and thoughts penned in a badly butchered version of the English language. The spelling made me suspect the author had had little in the way of formal education and had lived many centuries ago. After studying it for some time, I opened my own journal and began to write down what I believed was a fair translation. The first page picked up in the middle of a lengthy diatribe about the light and the dark, which I swiftly realized meant the seely and unseely, and how dastardly and evil they both were. I already knew that. However, halfway through the page, I found this. So I ken the light may nay touch the dark, nay may the dark touch the light. Wherefore the dark may nay bear such touch, so doth the sword fell it low. Wherefore the light may nay bear such evil, so the beast reviles it. Okay, so that sounded like the seely hated the unseely and vice versa, but not quite. There was something more here. I puzzled over it several moments. Did it mean the seely couldn't actually touch the unseely and vice versa? I read on. The sword doth fell them both, yea, e'en master and mist. I to have the blade and end my suffering. The sword killed both unseely and seely, up to the highest royalty. I knew that, too. So did the spear. So may ye try and ken them, that the light may nay touch the beast, nor the dark the sword, nor the light the amulet, nor the dark the spear. So you may try and know them, I scribbled my translation. The light, seely, may not touch the beast, book, and the dark, unseely, may not touch the sword. I get it, I exclaimed. This was important stuff. The seely can't touch the amulet, I wrote, and the unseely can't touch the spear. What it was saying was that the seely couldn't touch the unseely hallows, and unseely couldn't touch the seely hallows, and that was how you could tell them apart. I just found the perfect way to lay my questions to rest about whether or not Barons might be a gripper. If he was, he couldn't touch the spear. I lay my pen aside, thinking back. Had I ever seen him touch it? Yes, the night he'd stabbed the gray man while I'd hung suspended by my hair. I narrowed my eyes. Actually, I hadn't seen him touch it that night. When he'd returned it to me, the hilt was still stuck in my purse, with the spear protruding from it. He'd handled it through the fabric. And although he'd said he was going to wear it to the auction, strapped to his leg, I'd never pulled up his pants leg and gone looking for it. For all I knew, he might have left it laying on the desk, right where I'd placed it for him, and where I'd later reclaimed it. Okay, but the night we'd stolen the spear, surely he'd touched it at some point, hadn't he? I closed my eyes, replaying the memory. We'd gone underground and broken into the Irish mobster Rocky O'Banion's treasure chamber. Barons had made me pluck it from the wall and carry it to the car. He'd instructed me to break the rotting shaft from the spearhead. I'd been carrying it ever since. I opened my eyes. Clever, clever man. I had to put him in a position where he had no choice but to hold the spear. To take it, touch it. I would settle for no less than skin on steel. If he were a gripper, or an unseelie of any kind, he wouldn't be able to do it. It was that simple. So how was I going to trick him into taking it? These pages had been worth Danny's efforts for this tidbit alone. I was glad the book on Blaine had been gone, and this had been there in its place. I resumed reading. It was slow going, but fascinating. The author of the pocket notebook was no she-seer. Its scribe was a man, or rather a young boy, who'd been so beautiful he was mocked by the warriors of his time, though loved by the lasses who'd taught him his letters. At 10 and 3, he'd had the misfortune of capturing the eye of a fairy princess while taking a shortcut through a dark and tangled wood. She had charmed and seduced him off to fairy, where she'd swiftly transformed into something cold and frightening. She'd kept him locked in a golden cage at court, where he'd been forced to watch the fae play with their human pets. Among their games, their favorite was turning mortals prior into creatures who begged for the touch of a fae, any fae. In fact, for the touch of anything at all, for the vilest of things to be done to them, and to do foul things to each other, according to the young scribe. These creatures had no will, no mind, no awareness of anything but sexual need. They knew neither morality nor mercy, and were as likely to turn on one another as rabid animals. The boy had found them terrifying, and feared being given to what had become of his human companions. He had no way of tracking time, but he watched hundreds come and go, and began a growth of manly hair, which was when the princess began once more to look his way. When the fae were no longer amused with their pets, they cast them from fairy to die. In this manner, the letter of the compact wasn't violated. They didn't actually kill the humans they captured. They just didn't save them. I wondered how many had died in madhouses, or been used for exactly what they wanted, and killed by their own kind. The boy listened to all that was said, recorded all he heard, because when the dying were discarded, their possessions went with them, and although he'd lost hope for himself, he hoped to warn his people. The child hadn't known that hundreds of years would have passed by the time he was released from fairy. He hoped something he recorded might save one of them, perhaps hold the key to one day destroying his terrifying, merciless abductors. A chill kissed my nape. That his plan had worked meant the boy was long dead. And as he'd hoped, his notebook had found its way back to the world of man, and eventually into the hands of a she-seer, to be passed down through the centuries and end up in Rowena's desk. Why was it in her desk? Just some light reading at lunchtime? Or was she looking for something? I glanced at the clock. It was 2:30, well into afternoon. I snatched up my cell phone and dialed the ALD again. There was no answer. Where had the dreamy-eyed boy gone? Where was Christian? I snapped my laptop closed and was thinking of heading over there when my cell rang. It was Danny, and the girls were already at the pub waiting for me, so could I hurry? When I descended the stairs into the shadowy, sub-street-level pub, I found 7 women in their mid-to-late 20s waiting for me, not including Danny. 2 had been present the day Moira had died, the tall, gray-eyed brunette with the unwavering gaze that kept sweeping the pub, and I doubted she missed much, and the skinny, dark-eyed girl with platinum hair, heavy black eyeliner, and matching nail polish, who was rocking slightly in a chair to a rhythmic beat, although her iPod and earbuds lay on the table. The only exit was the entrance I'd come in, and, with no windows, the place felt dark and claustrophobic to me. As I took my seat, I could see they were as uncomfortable as I was with our close, dimly lit surroundings. 5 cell phones lay on the table, emitting wan glows. There were 2 notebooks open, running on battery power, displaying bright white screens. It was all I could do not to pull out my flashlights, turn them on, and slap them down on the table, adding my share to the lot. We nodded stiffly to each other. I got straight to the point. "Do you have unrestricted access to the library Rowena told me about?" I asked the group of women. I wanted to know just how useful an alliance between us might be. The brunette answered, "It depends on your place in the organization. There are 7 circles of ascension. We're in the 3rd, so we can enter 4 of the 21 libraries."
21?
Who could possibly use that many books? I said irritably. I'd bet there was no handy card catalog around either. She shrugged.
We've been collecting them for millennia.
Who's in the 7th circle? Rowena?
The 7th is the Haven itself. The High Council of... you know.
That level gray gaze swept the pub uneasily. I glanced around, too. There were 5 customers in the place. 2 were shooting pool, the other 3 were brooding into their beers. None of them were paying any attention to us, and there wasn't a fey in sight.
If you don't feel comfortable talking in a public place, why did you ask me to pick one?
We didn't think you'd meet in private after what happened. I'm Kat, by the way, the brunette said. This is Sorka, Claire, Mary, and Mo.
She pointed to each in turn. The skinny goth was Josie. The petite brunette was Shauna.
That's the lot of us, Kat said, though if you prove useful, and your loyalties are true, more will join us.
Oh, I'm useful, I said coolly.
The question is, are you? And as for loyalties, if yours are with the old woman, I suggest you rethink them.
Her gaze cooled to match mine.
Moira was my friend, but I saw what I saw, and you didn't mean to kill her. Doesn't mean I have to like it, and doesn't mean I have to like you. It does mean I'm after doing everything I can to stop the walls from coming down, and if that means I have to join forces with the only person I know can sense the book. Here I am. But back to loyalties. Where are yours?
Where any she-seers should be, with the humans we're supposed to protect. I didn't say what else I was thinking, in exactly this order. My family, my vengeance, the rest of the world. She nodded. Very good. The leader of a cause is never the cause itself. But make no mistake, we listen to Rowena. She's been training most of us since we were born. Though she didn't teach from birth, she spent years gathering and educating.
Then why are you going behind her back and meeting with me?
All 8, including Danny, shifted uncomfortably and either glanced away or fiddled with something, a coffee mug, a napkin, a cell phone. It was Danny who finally broke the silence.
We used to guard the book, Mac. It was ours to protect. We lost it.
What? I exclaimed. You lost it?
I've been blaming the Fae for the mess we were in, for making Darok human, but the She-Seers were complicit too?
How did you lose it?
Then again, knowing what I knew of it, how had they contained it to begin with? How had any She-Seer gotten close to it? Weren't they all repelled by it, like me?
We don't know, Kat said. It happened 20-some years ago, before any of us came to the Abbey. Those who lived through those dark days share little detail about them. One day it was there, hidden beneath the Abbey. Then it was gone.
So that was why Arlington Abbey had been continuously rebuilt and fortified ever stronger, because beneath it they'd been protecting the greatest menace known to man. How long had it been there, hidden in ground, guarded by whatever was held sacred by each age? Since it had been a Sheehan? Before even that?
Or so we've heard,
she continued. Only the Haven knew it was there to begin with. The night it vanished, they say terrible things happened. She sees died, others disappeared, and rumors flew, until the entire abbey knew what had once been hidden beneath their very feet. That was when Rowena formed PHI, and opened branches all over the world, with couriers out in the streets, listening for even a vague rumor of it. She's been trying to track it since. For many years there was no account of it, but recently it surfaced, right here, in Dublin. There are many of us who fear it was our predecessor's failure to contain it that has caused the problems we're having now, and only by getting it back do we have any chance to fix them. If you can sense the book, Mac, then you really are our best hope, like... She trailed off, as if reluctant to say the word aloud. She stared into her coffee, but I saw what she struggled to hide. Pure, raw fascination. Like Danny, she was smitten. She cleared her throat. Like the fae you brought that night said. She wet her lips. Elaine.
Rowena says you're dangerous,
Josie said hotly, raking a black-nailed hand through a fringe of pale bangs.
We told her you could sense it, but she doesn't want you to go after it. She says if you find it, you won't do what's right, that you want revenge. She says you told her that your sister was killed in Dublin, so she did some checking, and your sister was a traitor. She was working with him, the one who's been bringing all the Unseelie through.
Alina wasn't a traitor, I cried. Every occupant in the place turned to look at me. Even the bartender dragged his attention from the small TV behind the bar. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. Alina didn't know who he was, I said, carefully modulating my voice. He tricked her. He's very powerful. How had Rowena found out about Alina's involvement with the LM?
So you say, Cat said softly. Those were fighting words. I rose from my seat, hands splayed on the table. She rose too.
Easy, Mac. Hear me out. I'm not accusing you or your sister. If I truly believed you traitors to our cause, I wouldn't be here. I saw the look on your face when Moira...
She broke off, and I saw deep, unspoken grief in her eyes. They had been close. Still, she was here, trying to connect with me because she believed it was best for our cause.
We are not here to speak of the dead, but to plan for the living,
she continued after a moment.
I know that things are not always what they seem. We learn that from birth. But you can see the bind we're in. We need you, but we don't know you. Rowena is against you, and, while we normally support her in all things, her attempts to recover the book have failed. She has tried many times. We need results, and time is of the essence. You asked Danny for a show of faith, and she gave you it. Now we're asking you to return the favor.
I bit back an instinctive refusal. What do you want? I'd vowed never to prove myself to the old woman, but these women were not Rowena. I badly wanted to be invited to the abbey again. They were the only people I knew who were like me. I had been banned from the only club I'd ever wanted to join. With Blaine's name on my tongue, I wouldn't be at their mercy at the isolated fortress. If things took a threatening turn, he'd be there to rescue me the moment I opened my mouth.
Can you sense all fae objects?
I shrugged. I think so.
Have you heard of the Dajai orb?
When I nodded, she leaned forward and said urgently, Do you know where it is? I shrugged. I'd been holding it in my hands a little over 2 weeks ago, but I had no idea where it was right now, only that it was in Baron's possession.
Why?
It's important, Mac. We need it.
Why? What is it?
A relic from one of the Seelie royal houses that contains some kind of fae energy that Rowena believes can be used to reinforce the walls. We need it fast, before Samhain.
Samhain? What's Samhain?
If you can get the orb and bring it to us, we'll tell you everything we know, Mac. Even Rowena will have to believe in you then.
Chapter 11. I hurried back to the bookstore, deep in thought. Not, however, with my head down. I wasn't making that mistake again today. I won the struggle not to frown at two rhino boys that were repairing a street lamp. What was their deal? Shouldn't they be supporting their dark brethren, the shades, and busting out the lights instead of fixing them? I couldn't believe the she-seers had been guardians of the book and lost it. How had it been lost? What had happened that night, 20-some years ago? My meeting with the she-seers had answered few questions and raised more. What was sewing? How did the Dajai orb fit in? How had Barons gotten it? What did he plan to do with it? Sell it to the highest bidder? Could I steal it from him? Did I want to burn that bridge? Were there any bridges left between us? If the orb was my passport to She-Seer Central, I was determined to get it, by fair means or foul. Was Rowena manipulating their efforts to befriend me? Had she allowed Danny to photograph those pages and give them to me, seemingly on the sly? My short time in Dublin had me looking for games within games everywhere I turned. I'd sure like to get Christian into the same room with a few people and employ his lie-detecting abilities while I asked questions. Speaking of the Scot, I tried calling him again. There was no answer, again. Grr. Wondering what exactly constituted afternoon in the dreamy-eyed boy's world, I let myself into the store, opened my laptop, and logged onto the net. My search for sewing yielded no results. I tried half a dozen different spellings, and was about to give up when a Google search result caught my eye. It was about trick-or-treating, which brought to mind O'Banion's earlier crack. I looked up Halloween, and bingo, there it was. Sewing. Gee, why didn't I think of spelling it S-A-M-H-A-I-N? Sewing had its origins, like many modern holidays or celebrations, in pagan times. As the she-seers had been inclined to erect churches and abbeys on their sacred sites, the Vatican had been wont to Christianize ancient pagan celebrations in an if-you-can't-beat-them-and-don't-want-to-join-them-rename-it-and-pretend-it-was-yours-all-along campaign. Scrolling past the various names, etymology, and pictures of jack-o'-lanterns and witches, I read, Samhain. The word for November in the Gaelic language marks the beginning of the dark half of the Gaulish year, with Beltane adventing the light half. Great. So these past few months hadn't been the dark ones? Technically, Samhain refers to November 1st, christened All Saints' Day by the Vatican, but it's Samhain night, Iha Hauna, October 31st, that has long been the focus of ritual and superstition. Celts believed All Hallows' Eve was one of the liminal, Latin meaning threshold, times of the year, when spirits from the other world could slip through, and when magic was most potent. Since the Celts held that both their dead and the terrifying immortal she resided in mounds beneath the earth, on this night both could rise and walk freely. Festivals were held, and large communal bonfires were lit to ward off these evil spirits. I read entry after article, astonished by how many countries and cultures held similar beliefs. I'd never given any thought to the origins of Halloween, just happily collected the candy, and in later years had a blast with the costumes and parties, and enjoyed the great tips if I was working. Bottom line was the walls between our world and the other world were dangerously thin on the last day of October, at their most vulnerable at precisely midnight, the crack between one half of the year and the next, the threshold between light and dark, and if anything was going to try to get through, or if anyone, say an evil ex-fay with vengeance issues, wanted to bring them crashing down around our ears, that was the time to try it.
"Certain nights of the year, lass," Christian had told me. "My uncles perform rituals to reinforce our pledge and keep the walls between our realms solid. The last few times some other dark magic rose up and prevented the tithe from being fully paid. My uncles believe the walls won't last through another incomplete ritual."
Certain nights. Wouldn't last through another incomplete ritual. Was Samhain the night the McKelters' next ritual was to be performed? Were we that close to disaster? 2 short weeks away? Was this the meaning of O'Banion's snide threat? I thumbed redial and called the ALD again. Again there was no answer. The waiting had been making me crazy all day, and now I didn't just need to warn him, I needed answers. Where was he? Powering down my laptop, I locked up and headed for Trinity. Surprisingly, I dozed off, slumped sideways against the wall outside the locked offices of the ALD. I think it was because I felt like Mac 1.0 there, in the brightly lit hallway on a college campus, surrounded by the happy sounds of youth that didn't have a clue what was waiting for them out in the real world. I woke to someone touching my face, and my inner she-seer exploded. The next thing I knew, Christian was on the floor beneath me, and my spear was at his throat. My muscles were rigid. I was ready for a fight. My adrenaline had no outlet. Dreams had shattered the moment I'd felt myself touched. My brain was cold, clear, and hard. I took a deep breath and ordered myself to relax. Christian nudged the spear from his throat.
Easy, Mac. I was just trying to wake you. You look so sweet and pretty asleep.
His smile was fleeting.
I'll not be making that mistake again.
We separated awkwardly. As I've said before, Christian is a man, and there's no mistaking it. I'd been straddling him much the way I'd straddled Barons recently. Either my spear hadn't intimidated him, or he'd managed to, well, rise above it. Speaking of my weapon, his gaze was fixed on it with fascination. It was emitting a soft, luminous glow.
It's the Spear of Destiny, isn't it?
He looked awed. I slid it back in my shoulder harness and said nothing.
Why didn't you tell me you had it, Mac? We've been bidding on it, trying to buy it. We thought it was out there on the black market. We need it now more than ever. That's one of only 2 weapons that can kill.
I know. It kills, Fay. That's why I have it. And I didn't tell you because it's mine, and I'm not giving it up.
I didn't ask you to. There's nothing I could do with it, anyway. I can't see them.
Right. And that's why you shouldn't have it.
A little touchy, are we?
I flushed. I was. Someone tried to steal it from me recently, and it went badly, I explained. Where have you been, anyway? I've been calling you all day. I was getting worried.
My plane was delayed.
He unlocked the door and pushed it open.
I'm glad you're here. I was going to call you as soon as I got in. My uncles have an idea they want me to talk to you about. I think it's a terrible idea, but they insist.
So in is the night your uncles have to perform the next ritual, isn't it? I said as we stepped inside. And if they don't get it right, the walls between our worlds are going to come down, and we're all screwed. I shivered. It had sounded weirdly like I'd just made a proclamation. The walls between our worlds are going to come down, and we're all screwed. Christian closed the door behind me.
Smart girl. How'd you figure it out?
He gestured to a chair opposite his, but I was too wound up to take it. I paced instead. The She-Seers mentioned Soin. They want... I trailed off and looked at him hard, searching his gaze for... I don't know. Maybe a big block-lettered message that said, "You can trust me, I'm not evil." I sighed. Sometimes you just have to take a leap of faith. They want the Dajai orb to try to reinforce the walls. Would it work? He rubbed his jaw, and it made a rasping sound. He hadn't shaved in several days, and the shadow beard looked good on him.
I don't know. It's possible. I've heard of it, but I don't know what it does. Who are these She-Seers? You found more of your own, then?
You're kidding, right? He knew so much about Barons and the book that I'd assumed he also knew about Rowena and her couriers, and probably Vlaine, too. He shook his head. You said you followed Alina. Didn't you see other women out there watching things that weren't there?
I had reasons to watch your sister. She had a photocopy of a page of the Shisadu. I've had no cause to watch others.
I got the impression your uncles knew everything. Christian smiled.
They'd like that. They think quite highly of themselves, too. But no, for a long time we believed all the she-seers had died out. A few years ago, we discovered we'd been wrong. How many have you come across?
A few. I hedged. He didn't need to know. Blaine and Barron's knowing about the Abbey was bad enough.
Not the truth, but it'll do. You can keep the numbers to yourself. Just tell me this. Are there enough to put up a fight if we need them to?
I didn't sugarcoat the sour fact. Not with only two weapons. So what's this terrible idea of your uncle's?
A while back, they had a run-in with Barron's, and they've been toying with the idea since. They're no longer toying. Uncle Cain says power is power, and we need all of it we can get.
I narrowed my eyes. What kind of run-in? Where?
At a castle in Wales, a month and a half ago. They'd been chasing the same relics for some time, but never actually tried to rob the same place on the same night.
Those were your uncles? The other thieves that were after the amulet the night Malouche took it? The night Blaine had snatched me out, sifted me off to a beach in Ferry.
You know where the amulet is? Who is Malouche? And they aren't thieves. Some things shouldn't be loose in the world.
Malouche is dead and no longer matters. The Lord Master has it now.
Who's the Lord Master?
I was astonished. What did he know? Anything of use? He's the one who's been bringing the Unseelie through, the one who's been trying to tear the walls down. He looked blank.
He's the one who's been doing the magic against us.
Duh, I said.
Don't be doing me, lass,
he growled, his burr thickening. How can you know so many things but none of the important ones? You're the ones who are supposed to be protecting the walls.
Right, the walls,
he said.
And we've been doing it, to the best of our ability, with our own blood. Can't try much harder than that, lass, unless you want us to revert to the archaic ways and sacrifice one of our own, an idea I just went home to explore, but was forced to conclude wouldn't work. What about the she-seers? Aren't they supposed to be doing something, too?
He cast my accusation of slacking off on the job right back at me. Yes, as a matter of fact, they were. They were supposed to be protecting the book. I distanced and acquitted myself. He opened his mouth, closed it again, then exploded.
You're the ones who had the she-seer to begin with? We knew somebody was guarding it. We just didn't know who. Ach, for the love of Christ, lass! What did you do with it? Lose the bloody thing.
I clarified my pronouns again. They lost it. I'm not part of them.
You certainly look like a she-seer to me.
Don't be trying to blame me, Scotty, I snapped. Your uncles were supposed to be keeping the walls up. The she-seers were supposed to be guarding the book. The Fae was supposed to strip the LM's memory before they dumped him on us, and I was supposed to be home with my sister playing volleyball on a beach somewhere. It's not my fault. None of this is my fault. But for some idiotic reason, I seem to be able to do something about it. And I'm trying, so get off my back. We faced off, breathing fast and shallow, glaring at each other. Two young people living in a world that was coming apart at the seams, doing their best to stop it, but realizing rapidly just how long the odds were. Tough times make for tough words, I guess. "What's your terrible idea?" I said finally, in an effort to get things back on track. He inhaled and released it slowly.
"My uncles want Barron's to help them hold the walls on Sowin. They say he's druid-trained and not afraid of the dark side."
I laughed. No, he certainly wasn't afraid of the dark side. Some days I was pretty sure he was the dark side. You're right. It's a terrible idea. Not only does he know you guys have been spying on him, Barron's is mercenary to the core. He doesn't give a rat's petunia about anyone but himself. Why would he care if the walls come down? Everybody's afraid of him. He has nothing to lose.
What did you just say?
In a nutshell, he doesn't care.
You said he knows we've been spying on him? How?
I gave myself a mental smack in the forehead. I'd completely forgotten the reason I'd come here in the first place. I hastily recounted how Barons had used voice to interrogate me about my recent activities, and that visiting Christian had been one of them. I told him I'd been trying to reach him all day, to warn him, and when I had